Welcome back to the latest edition of Good Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined as almost always by my colleague from The Athletic, Stuart Mandel. We appreciate our buddy Max Olson for filling in last week. Stu, you couldn't join us on the podcast last week, but you have a...
I think I had a valid reason. Yeah, not to go all dark on the podcast, but my mom passed away last Monday, April 29th. So I was back in Cincinnati for about 8 or 9 days. Just coming back to work now. Obviously, it was shocking, sad, but also a lot of joy that's come in the last week from seeing all her friends, seeing all my friends, family, reminiscing, going through her stuff. You know, pretty much every emotion, Bruce, every emotion you can experience, I've experienced in the last 9 or 10 days. But as people always say, like, one of the things that helps is a return to normalcy. So my mind was definitely not in the college football space for a while there, but I'm catching up now. I'm glad to be back. And as I kind of got back online in the last couple of days, one of the first things that caught my attention is Brian Kelly. Think it's 2013 or 2021, maybe, with some of his comments about NIL.
Yeah, it definitely caught, got some traction. And I think, I don't know if it was a polarizing kind of comment, how it landed. To me, it's hard to, I mean, I'm trying to say, it's like, if you're the LSU coach, did it seem like it was taken out of context, or I don't know. It was one of those.
He said it on camera, so it's hard to be taken out of context.
Yeah, I think he had a long sit down with one of the local anchors, and let me find the exact quote so I don't take it out of context. Because the headline is basically, Brian Kelly says LSU isn't in the business of buying players. And this is what he told Jock Doucette of WAFB. And this is in the context of they were in the market for a lot of interior defensive linemen, and this, you know, supply and demand is big there, and they have not had a lot of success on the portal front in that regard. Quote, it hasn't fared very well, quite frankly, Kelly said, because we're selling something a little different, and that is we want to recruit, we want to engage, build relationships, develop, retain, and have success. We're not in the market of buying players. And unfortunately, right now, that's what some guys are looking for. They want to be bought, end quote.
Yeah, it sounds like something a coach would have said 2 years ago when this was really first becoming a thing. And there were a lot of coaches who were saying, hey, no, we're not going to be playing that game. But, you know, obviously, for the most part, that's just, people have come to realize that's the way it works now. And in fact, it's not even against the rules now. Like, you don't have to be shy about it. Look, these coaches.
Yes, though, also, he continued, but if you're looking to get paid, you're looking in the wrong place. And then he added, if you just want to get paid, this is not the place for you. Now, I think, I don't know what coach would be advertising and saying that, you know, certainly.
He's basically saying, I'll get to what I think he was really saying, but how it comes off and what he's really saying is, you know, and I think Max talked about this on the show he filled in for me on, how there was, you know, beyond quarterback, the most coveted position in the portal this year was defensive lineman. And because of that, they were able to garner a lot of money from these collectives. And I think what he's insinuating is these guys were asking for way more money than we think they're worth, right? Like, because it's not like they have nobody on their roster that's getting money from a collective. He praised their collective. I'm sure that Jaden Daniels was very well compensated when he was at LSU. But, you know, we do hear stories all the time of guys in the portal making outrageous demands and then basically school basically saying, yeah, sorry, you know, like, we can't offer that. And I think if he had come out and said that, nobody would have thought twice about it. But he just really kind of went over the top and made it seem like, I mean, some of those words you just said, you might as well just be putting up a big billboard that says, don't come here. Because like guys do expect to be paid to some extent, and he makes it. It's almost like he generalized a little too much. We're not going to pay for players. We only want guys that come here to be developed and make it to the NFL. But it's not like LSU is the only program that can sell that, right? Georgia can sell that. Alabama, Ohio State, Michigan, you name it.
No one else could sell that again. And it's a team that beat them last year. Florida State, like went heavy in the portal. Mike Norvell's program has, we could rattle off like almost every big time player they had on that, 13-0 team that won the ACC felt like a portal guy that flourished. And if you look at their D-line room, and again, I'm not saying if Jared Verse didn't leave as an Albany Great Dane and finish his career there, he probably maybe still is a first round pick, but he went there. Braden Fisk, left the MAC and tore it up in the ACC. And it seemed like those guys, did not just flourish, but were developed and, taken to the next level. And it's not to say Florida State's the only school that's doing that, but, and I don't think Brian Kelly was like singling out, oh, the only people, the players we're not getting, it's just because they're only about money, kind of thing. But that's, so it's, I also wonder, like, if Mike Elko said that, not Brian Kelly, do you think it would have gotten anywhere near the traction?
It would have gotten attention just because it's an SEC, head coach of a major program. But Brian Kelly is somebody who tends to, he has a history of saying things that catch attention. And in this case, I think, it's kind of like a three-pronged thing that happened here. First of all, in terms of context, they did sign guys out of the portal last year. They didn't hit, and you talked about it last season. Like they got these guys, these DBs who had starting experience elsewhere, and then they got there and it turned out they weren't that good. So that really hurt them last year. That's strike one. Strike two is he kind of prematurely tried to call his shot at the end of spring practice. He acknowledged like they lost two DTs in the NFL they weren't expecting. And he said on April 1st, I think we're going to be able to address that position in short order, as in kind of calling a shot that we're going to go in the portal and get some defensive tackles. And instead, Dominic Williams from TCU chose Oklahoma. Simeon Barrow from Michigan State chose Miami. I believe there's another guy who went to Oregon. He didn't get any of them. So now you come out and you kind of seem like you're making excuses. These guys wanted too much money, so we just didn't get them. Okay, fine. Strike three, though, is going to be if you come out this coming season and you're not good on defensive line. Because I don't think the fans are going to use, well, they were asking too much money. Good thing we didn't go after. No, that's just, they don't want excuses. They want a good defense. They had a terrible defense last year. And I hope for Brian Kelly's sake, since he showed restraint and didn't go after the guys who were all about the money, that they do have some defensive tackles there in Baton Rouge.
Yeah, the other thing that's tricky for them is they've had, Mason Smith enters the draft after 3 years, obviously former five-star line recruiter was hurt a lot there, has talent, but also he had like six position coaches in 3 years. Like that's a staggering amount of turnover there. And I'm not saying that was, a lot of it was, it would happen with Brian Kelly and it wouldn't have if there was another coach there, but that's, it's hard to develop guys when there's that much of a revolving door for all sorts of reasons, at that position.
And then on top of that, on Wednesday, Boise State coach Spencer Danielson got a little bit of Twitter hot water when one of the beat writers tweeted out that he said freshmen were ineligible for NIL deals. He wants them to earn it. And then there was a clarification. He doesn't mean like they can't, but some people took it as they were saying if you're a freshman, you can't like go out and get a car dealership ad. No, they're not going to try to stop that. But they're saying that the collective, they don't want the collective promising money to freshmen. They want them to earn it. A very admirable stance, and one that's just not going to fly in today's culture. There have been stories, while I was out about the settlement talks and the House case and how we're coming closer to finally having an era where the schools just pay the players directly. So somebody who's out there saying like, we were not going to pay the freshmen, they need to earn it, is kind of speaking from a older era.
Yeah, you had mentioned to me, Before we were, when we were talking about setting up this show today, you had mentioned about, the new Boise State head coach said something that really, I don't know how you described it, but I was like, I think I missed this. And so I went and looked it up in the headlines. You know, there's an on three headline. Boise State coach Spencer Danielson declares freshman won't get NIL via Broncos in first year with program. Then the third headline that you can find on Google, Boise State football coach bans freshman from making money.
These coaches, as soon as they open their mouth, the aggregation game begins and it gets worse. The direct quote was, "If you're looking for the easy way and you're looking for a handout, don't come to Boise State." I think it's generally speaking, word of advice for all football coaches, never say out loud in any context the words, "Don't come to my school." Because guess who's gonna use that? The schools you're recruiting against. Now, I don't think, to be fair, I don't think any freshman at a Mountain West school, Boise State or otherwise, was going to get rich from their collective. It's not like Boise State is out there beating out Oregon for recruits.
Yeah, I do want to stop you on that a little bit, just because there was a huge recruit in the state of Idaho, Gatlin Bear, who's like a blazing fast receiver, who had committed to Boise State a while back, but then ended up decommitting, and decommitting, and ended up someplace else. And so he would have been the guy that. Absolutely would have, I'm sure would have gotten something if he had ended up there and not as an Oregon Duck.
Okay.
That's, obviously rare. That guy was the five-star kid from in-state. Like I said, incredibly fast, not a small receiver either. He's a whatever 6'1", 190-pound guy. I imagine he will be a big addition for Oregon this season, but that would have been the exception, I think, to that.
I don't think most of their recruits were going to make considerable money from the collective, but we are seeing just kind of universally, not universally, but widespread acceptance that part of being a college football player is you get some minimum, like across the board, where every player on the team gets X. It might not be very much, but something. So I wouldn't want to be out there advertising that we don't pay. If you come here, you will make $0 as a freshman.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Because it's been a while since we've done a show together, and probably even longer before that than that we answered emails, we have quite a few saved up as far back as the NFL draft, which happened before I left California. After our most recent episode, or after the last episode we did together. So, what do you say we dive into some emails, Bruce?
Sounds good. As always, send your questions to the audiblepod@gmail.com. The first question I wanted to ask you, Stu, is this question is from Brian Black in Atlanta. Hey, Bruce and Stu, big fan of the podcast. Thank you, Brian. There were two draft records highlighted over the weekend. Nick Saban's 49 first round picks and Georgia's record 15 draft picks. Some thought Michigan might pass Georgia's record, but came up short. In the age of NIL and the transfer portal, it seems unlikely any coach will be able to keep enough high-level talent and depth to break any of these records. But which of these records is most likely to be broken? Good question.
That's a good question. And by the way, you were the one who first reported a year ago of Jim Harbaugh saying he thought they would break Georgia's record. They didn't quite get there, but they came close. So, good on you putting that out into the public sphere. And by the way, it doesn't end there. I've seen these early 2025 mocks that have Will Johnson, Mason Graham, like that Michigan national title team is not done producing draft picks.
Yeah, Donovan Edwards was one that Harbaugh had mentioned, but he obviously opted to, you know, there was a couple of guys who opted to stay who could have come out that he thought when they were getting to 20, he was like, oh, this would be, you know, those guys would be in that group. But anyway.
I think the one that I'm going to rule out first is Saban's, just because I think it's going to be, we're just not going to see coaches have that level of sustained elite success for that long at one place. Kirby Smart would obviously be the front runner to do so. He's obviously put a lot of guys.
Yeah, I would say this is not 49 at Alabama, though.
Okay, so 49 first round draft. I mean, that's a testament to not just elite coaching, but longevity. And we are seeing that the pace of this sport is starting to, the calendar of this sport is starting to, you know, make it harder to stay on the job for that long. But in terms of the per school, I do think that was a phenomenal record by Georgia. But I'm not going to say it can never be broken, because we're kind of already seeing a consolidation of talent, of elite talent at a small handful of schools. So I don't think it's, I mean, Georgia might do that again, right?
Look, Ohio State
might do it next year.
Ohio State could do that next year. Now, look, some of these guys, like, I have no idea if Will Howard will be the starting quarterback. If he is, I suspect he will get drafted somewhere. I doubt he will get drafted in the top 20, but if he's a fifth round pick, that would still count. You know, the both running backs, you know, you got a bunch of receivers, you obviously have a bunch of D linemen and DBs. But it's a long way off between now and then. I remembered ESPN had a graphic up during the draft, and I remember seeing it and thinking, because it was Saban, and then, you know, I remember there was Joe Paterno reference. I think Urban was the fifth guy. But, like, somewhere in there, like, Butch Davis had 35 guys. He was not on in their graphic, you know, because he had that many when he was at Miami. He had a bunch
Wait, draft picks or first-round draft picks?
First rounds.
Butch Davis had 35?
35. Now, I don't know if they made the distinction of saying had coached, as opposed to Butch recruited technically a bunch and then left right before he got to coach.
Yeah.
Six.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just don't feel like he was the head coach long enough to have produced that many. But I guess if you're counting.
The Miami run was insane of the first round picks. But then he had another batch of them at North Carolina.
Yeah, true. Just to give you a sense of how long it might take somebody to get to Nick Saban's record, Kirby Smart, reigning number one coach on both of our top 25 lists, two-time national champion, coach of that school, that team with 15, has 17 first-round picks. That's a long ways to 49.
He's barely a third of the way there.
Yeah, that's insane. But yes, I do think somebody could break the per-school record. I mean, Ohio State, I'm not a draft expert, so I'm not going to like sit here and individually name, because I'm like, is this offensive lineman going to get drafted or not? But just like bare minimum guys on this year's team who could be drafted next year. I mean, looking at their depth chart, I mean, practically the entire defense. Their starting defense next year is all guys that you would consider to be NFL draft prospects. And then you throw in Travion Henderson, Donovan Jackson, like you said, Will Howard, Mecca Buka, like 15 seems attainable. Speaking of the NFL draft, Blaine from Virginia, the top five, and I did think this was an interesting thing that happened. The top five teams on Selection Sunday were the same five teams that had the most NFL draft picks. There used to be vast, and we're talking, by the way, about Washington, we're talking about Michigan, Washington, Florida State, Alabama, and Texas. Those were the five teams. Now, it used to be that there were vast differentials between NFL draft and on-field success. Now it seems everyone runs basically the same. RPO, shotgun spread offense, and your talent dictates your success. Developing talent obviously remains paramount, but do you mourn the loss of variety from pro-style offense or even going back 30 years, the option? That is something that always distinguished college football from the NFL, was that you might have a game one week where you're playing, like, let's say, Jim Harbaugh, Stanford, and then the next week you're playing Chip Kelly, Oregon. We definitely don't see quite that wide of range anymore, but I don't think it's the case that that's why those numbers lined up the way they did. I mean, I think it's always been that, generally speaking, like, there have been schools that had a lot of draft picks that didn't do well, but, you know, you're going to be hard pressed to find schools that finished in the top five that didn't have a lot of NFL draft picks.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, it's weird because a year earlier you had TCU in there, and that wasn't a team that was like flush with a ton of draft picks.
They had quite a few, though.
Yeah. It just not to this. I mean, I'd be curious where they ranked.
I remember that the Cincinnati team in 2021 had 9, which was, you know, quite the feat for a group of five team. But again, showed like to be able to be in the position they were, like, you got to have some top end talent. And that's definitely going to be true in a 12-team playoff, of which teams advance to the end.
Yeah, just to count them up for TCU, last year they ended up with 8, which is obviously, it might be the biggest number they had in history. I don't know. I'm trying to remember, there was like, it looks like it is the most they ever had. So
I think what we do still have in college football is some teams, and I would use Jamie Chadwell's teams as an example, that compensate for lack of NFL players with creative schemes. Like, those teams exist. They're just not the ones competing for national championships.
Yeah, no, but I ultimately think, not to get all Ari on anybody, but I also think, you know, when they played Oregon in the Fiesta Bowl, like, it was a lopsided match. You know, it just, I don't know if that's what it's going to look like with a, you know, 12-1 or whatever the, you know, whatever it's going to be, where your group of five or your outlier program is in there and they just can't match up.
From Patrick in Pennsylvania, dear Bruce and Stu, first of all, I want to let you know that I'm coaching my daughter in soccer right now. I remember reading your piece last spring, Bruce, on coaching your son, and I want to thank you for sharing that story. Same with Stu on coaching your daughter in softball. I used to coach high school football, but this has been way more meaningful. Can't agree more with that. CFB question. He's an OSU graduate traveling to watch Ohio State or Oregon in the fall. Outside of the game, do you think this is the biggest game in the new Big Ten this year?
1,000%. Yes, I do. And there's so many layers to it to me, because you have the two teams right now that I would imagine are going to have the biggest NIL war chest on the line. You have Oregon going back there, where, again, I don't know how many people are going to circle back to this, but I definitely remember, you know, without Thibodeau, and I think they were missing a couple of players, people thought they were going to get smacked, and they ended up, like, credit to Joe Moorhead and Cristobal, but, like, Oregon's offense just took it to Ohio State, you know, in Columbus. And now Ohio State goes back there. We'll see what happens. It's obviously a homecoming for Chip Kelly of sorts now with a different team to go back to Eugene. I think it is one of the must-see games of the regular season. Obviously, to me, Ohio State, Michigan, given what's happened the last three times, and it's back in Columbus, like, I mean, I can't wait to get to that game just because I know what the recent history has looked like. But short of that, as you know, as Patrick said to me, this is the most compelling Big Ten game I can think of.
You know, I think on paper I agree. Right now, of course, how we think the teams are going to be in May isn't necessarily how it'll play out in the season. I also think, like, there's the novelty of these two teams playing as conference opponents. This is going to be like probably the first big example of an intersectional game you never imagined would be a Big Ten conference game. If I'm going to play devil's advocate, I would just say this will be a test of the Ari Wasserman, is the 12-team playoff going to water down the regular season? Because it is in the middle of October in a long season where the loser of that game is not really eliminated from anything. So will that lessen the stakes around it a little bit? Probably. But I just think, like, the novelty of it, it's going to be at Autzen, the place is going to be rocking. Like, that's the thing about college football. Whether the game's in September, October, or November, I think you'll have a great atmosphere, a big TV ratings number for Fox or for, well, I guess it's three now, right? Fox, CBS, or NBC. And people, a lot of star power in that game, to say the least. I'll be excited to see Dylan Gabriel playing for the Ducks in that game. By the way, if Penn State is finally, you know, delivers and is not the underachiever that it's been the last few years, Ohio State does play them in State College November 2nd. So that could end up being one of your biggest games of the season. Charles Bristow, with this is some recent news that flew under the radar. I was just wondering what your take is on Rutgers' decision to name a starting QB now, allowing Gavin Wimstat the opportunity to enter the portal when they could have kept the competition open and kept him locked in as the backup.
Yeah, it's a little interesting. So Wimstat is a Kentucky guy, and he'd been in, you know, he's transferring basically back home. He's going back to Kentucky. He was a big recruit for Greg Schiano, and they had a nice year last year. But I guess at this point, they took Ethan Kalikimanis, who had, you know, he has the ties to Kirk Shiraka from his time. Kirk Shiraka is obviously veteran Big Ten coordinator who had, you know, had been good at Minnesota. Then he was at Penn State, and now is at Rutgers. I think this is going to be, I don't know. It's like, I think he knows what he's looking at, and maybe felt more comfortable in this direction. You know, now you got Wimsett, who's transferring, and they just took Brock Vandegrift, who obviously was a big, big recruit for Georgia, got a lot of physical talent. He was a guy that I'm very interested to see it at Georgia, but, you know, we'll see if it's going to be a one and done. Cutter Bowley was a pretty big recruit for UK also. So the quarterback room at Kentucky is now certainly very interesting, because you had all sorts of, like, you know, I think this is the fourth coordinator in 4 years for them as well. You know, because, well, technically it's not fourth, it's the third, but you had, you know, you've just had a lot of turnover with guys coming from the NFL and going back to the NFL and coming from that, you know, like that kind of deal. So we'll see how Wimsett fits there.
To the point of the question, I was, you know, starting to think, especially now that we have unlimited transfers, you may never see another coach. This is me thinking a couple weeks ago. You may never see another coach name a quarterback in the spring because of this exact reason. Wait till August so that you at least have a backup when the season begins. He didn't do that.
Good on Schiano for that.
Yeah, good on him. I hope he's, you know, look, if I don't know what their depth is at quarterback, they could turn around and bring in somebody themselves. We'll see. And that is an interesting situation. Like, when Kentucky got Brock Vandegrift, that was a big deal. And you just kind of say, okay, we can pencil in who Kentucky's quarterback is for next year. Now, of course, is there anything stopping them from doing this? Like, okay, let's fast forward to August, and let's say that Mark Stoops names Wimstat, not Vandegrift, the starting quarterback on like August 26th. Can't Vandegrift turn around and transfer again?
It depends when school is started. I don't think he can be eligible and transfer then at that point.
He would have to be enrolled. Yeah, he would have to get there before class starts.
Yeah.
And so I don't know.
He's on the school. I mean, if he went to a trimester school, I have no idea if then it'd be able to play that late. I don't know. We'll see.
The point is, it's on the table now. It used to be like back in the old days of 6 months ago, you only got to do that once. Now you can do it twice in one off season if you wanted to.
All right, Stu, this question from Ryan Kiesling. Hey, Stu and Bruce, love the pod. Thank you, Ryan. Just wanted to clarify some things about the current ASU situation/disaster/debacle. Fans are furious here right now. People have gone on the radio pointing out Michael Crow is lying. He doesn't care. People have been telling Crow for years his view of athletics is outdated and wrong. He doesn't care. Why? Because he knows, as a school president, he's not going to get fired for athletics performance. And, in parentheses, he probably shouldn't. So what are the fans going to do? You have a president who isn't going anywhere, who doesn't listen to anybody, who simply doesn't understand or care about college athletics. We're basically like a pro sports team with a bad owner, stuck with them until they decide on their own to move on.
It's a good analogy. I think on the last podcast, when we talked about the sanctions that came down and Herm Edwards and Ray Anderson and whatnot, you know, I said it's apathy at Arizona State that this was allowed to go on for as long as it did. And maybe that's an unfair generalization. But to his point, what are the fans supposed to do? I mean, if this were an SEC school, certain Big Ten schools, et cetera, I mean, you would have trustees, important donors calling for the president's job, or going very public and vocal about withholding donations. Like, there would be some external pressure to change. I haven't seen any of that with ASU. Michael Crow is a very respected university president. And to Ryan's point, I don't think his job is in any danger based on what's going on in athletics. But these guys, you know, these universities don't like negative press. They don't like controversy. They're very controversy averse. If they had some big donors who were going public, Board of Regents people complaining about all this, you know, I think maybe some action would be taken. But instead, like, silence. And so, yes, Michael Crow flat out lied to people about the extent of Herm Edwards' involvement in the NCAA infractions case. He let Ray Anderson, who hired Herm Edwards and enabled all this, slink off to a professor job in the law school but keep his AD salary. Like, this is nuts. This is nutso stuff. But it doesn't seem like there's any pressure to hold anybody accountable for it. And I do think you would see that at if the same exact thing were going on at LSU.
I last week in Arizona, a couple of us were talking about just, you see a lot of people end up around college sports in consultant roles after they've kind of, I don't know, whether they've had a distinguished run or a disastrous run, they just can still collect a big check some way by just lingering around, because there's always somebody who will bring them in and pay them. It's almost like it's not their money, you know, kind of thing. And I feel like that's probably, you know, I mean, we know we deal in college sports, and it's probably not that unusual in the rest of the real world, but it definitely seems like there's like a cottage industry of failing outwards. I wouldn't even say it's upwards. It's like outwards, where it's just like they're floundering and they're doing this other stuff. I mean, me and a couple of people had a couple of specific names of like, oh yeah, this buffoon is still like, is involved. Not.
You're not going to name names?
I'm not naming names on this.
I know this, that event you were at in Phoenix, which I've been to several times, is kind of notorious for, like, you just look around the lobby of that hotel and be like, why is that guy here? Like, just people kind of found a way in on that junket who aren't particularly prominent in college athletics anymore, but they've been hanging around and they know the right people and they keep getting the right invites. You're absolutely right about that. Finally, Bruce, I including this because I know you have stories. So this is from Adam and Sam Engelbert, who spelled it out for me, Chandler, Arizona. We are saddened to hear the news a few weeks ago of Howie Schwab's passing. Stump the Schwab was must-see TV for some of our formative childhood years, and both he and the show were gone too soon. Do you happen to have any stories about Howie to share?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. So Howie was the one who gave me my biggest break in my career. He hired me when no newspapers were taking phone calls or whatever, and I'm grateful for that. I shared an office with him in Bristol for, I don't know how many years, a few years. And it was always very interesting to me because we were like, he was the guru. He was Google before Google. He was, and I'm not exaggerating about that. Like, now you can search anything. Back then you couldn't, you know, like, I remembered, this is back in the mid 90s. This is before most people had email. Never mind the internet. And I do remember, and I got stories I hadn't even thought about that I was going to tell, but like, so I got hired by Howie before he actually came over to the department. We We technically, I think I was the first hire of what became ESPN.com. Howie hired me, but he didn't come over.
Wait. Is that true? You are, is that a great piece of trivia? You were the first person ever hired for ESPN.com?
Yeah, I wasn't called ESPN.com. It was called like ESPNNet, and we were on Prodigy, which was an online service at the time. And somebody correct me on this one, but
I had no idea you were such a visionary.
I'm not a visionary. I'm just old,
You
Stu.
just needed a job.
So Howie hired me. All right, so I got an interview with him, and probably a year earlier, and the interview I felt like I crushed the interview because it was like, this is all just about sports. The only question I felt like I was like half leery of was like, he asked me about the Vezina trophy. And I like watch hockey, but I don't know it like know it. I think I said Patrick Waugh, which was not a bad answer. But like everything else was like total like my wheelhouse at the time. Like back then I knew more about followed baseball more than I did, certainly do now. But we just connected. And so he was going to hire me. It was right when ESPN2 was launching. And I remember I was living in Florida and I left and basically drove up I-95 thinking I got this job because it was there. And then I remember said goodbye to my grandfather. I didn't think I was going to see him again and got up to the Northeast and where I'm originally from. And he, turned out there was no job. They moved somebody over who was already hired to be like the ESPN2 college basketball researcher. So for about a year, I was in limbo, and I was living in a house we couldn't my family couldn't sell at the time. So and but I had played in a Howie called me at one point. He was like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Well, I'm playing in a semi-pro football league. I'm a wide receiver." And da da. He was like, "Oh." He was like, I was gonna see if you could take a drug test and come up and start working. And at the time, I could take a drug test, and so I did. And like, I started like a week or so later, and Howie was still running the research department. He was coming over, I want to say, like maybe November 1st, and this was like in the dead of the summer, like June, July of '94. And at one point, like we're doing all this stuff, and we had like two computer terminals. Everything else was like, this was back before there was an office full of computers. They had these other basis terminals, which if you're old and you worked in sports media, you might have known what they are, but you wouldn't know because it's like you're old, but you're not that old,
No, I actually do. I actually had those at Cincinnati Inquirer when I was there as an intern.
So at one point I said to Howie, I was like, Howie, do you think this thing is really gonna take off? Being like the internet, because we were going to have our launch at the Final Four was in Seattle that following year. And he goes, I don't know, but people a lot smarter than me and you think it is. So just get in the car, back of the car and start pushing. Like that was kind of the analogy. And obviously it did. But like we shared an office. And so people would come in all the time to like ask him all sorts of stuff. And I would sit there and listen. And I knew. Like I feel like I know trivia pretty well, but like it's football, it might be basketball, and it's a period and it's like a range. Howie, I would hear this stuff. I'm like, how the hell does he know so much about women's tennis and boxing? And there was like layers of it. And it was just kind of like, it would just kind of blow me away the pure trivia he knew when he had like all these sports almanacs, but he would know it off the top of top of his head. And it was just kind of like astounding. So that was kind of, all these people would come in and they were forever indebted to him. Like obviously Dick Vitale, and he had a great relationship, to his passing and to the point where I have a really, like I have a great Dick Vitale story where one year, this is back in the days of when I would cover the Final Fours, much like you did, you remember we probably were at some of them. And there was a year where it was in New Orleans. I don't know if this is the year where like Carmelo Anthony led Syracuse to the national title, I want to say. But anyway, we're in, and I'm flying down and I'm sitting next to a college kid who tells me he's a regular student at Penn State, but he was a high school basketball player who from New Jersey who is on the team that practices against the Penn State women's team. So we, good conversation or whatever. And then at some point he goes, I am hoping I run into Dick Vitale here because I want to give him, this must have been right when cell phones are out, because I want to pass him my cell phone so he can talk to my best friend who's battling cancer. And I just remember listening to this story. I'm like, the odds of this kid running into Dick Vitale on Bourbon Street or somewhere and this happened are really slim. But I'm like, I don't want to promise anything, but like, I share an office with Howie. Howie's Vitale's right-hand man. I was like, why don't you give me your number? And so he gave me his number and I told Howie. And then, like, and again, I don't know if this is still the case, but like, Dick Vitale's daughters kind of helped handle, I think, that part of like Dick Vitale's business, of helping people when it came to, Jimmy V matters or all sorts of stuff. So fast forward probably about 6 months, maybe even a year, I get a voicemail on my, I was at ESPN Magazine in our office, and I got a voicemail from this guy, and he is so excited about like how his friend has been like battling cancer. And he got a 2-minute voicemail just out of the blue from Dick Vitale. And it was the most, it was like pumped him up and everything. And then Dick Vitale was inviting him to the Coaches versus Cancer in, it was either at the Garden or it was in like New Jersey at the Meadowlands, whatever they were calling the Meadowlands back then. And Dick was bringing him up at halftime and this whole thing. And I was just like, got goosebumps hearing this, and it was like how he facilitated. Obviously, Dick did the heavy lifting and, and all that. And I was just like, oh, this was like some of the cool stuff about, where you worked and that you could see how, especially back in those days, people just worshiped ESPN. And obviously, Dick was a huge presence, and could impact so many people with what he did. Whether you loved him as an announcer or kind of like rolled your eyes at times, like all the amazing work he's still doing, on the behalf of cancer research was really cool. And like how he had a big part in always being Dick's right-hand guy. And to Dick's credit, he was, as far as I know, like always loyal to Howie, even after like he had, like a lot of folks, he didn't have a great exit from ESPN when they were squeezing people, in cost-cutting moves. So that is one of my long-winded Howie stories.
Yeah, I never knew him. I certainly knew of him even before the show. I mean, partially from you and your stories, and of course, because Dick Vitale always talked about him. I just thought it was really cool when they gave him the show, right? Like, not your typical sports TV personality by any means. First of all, it ran from 2004 to 2006. It does not feel like it was that long ago to me. And it only ran for 80 episodes. But I did think it was really cool when that was on, and like a researcher, granted a pretty prominent one, got his own TV show, albeit for that brief time. So I'm glad you were able to share that. I honestly did not know. You've told me a million times that you shared an office with him, and but I honestly did not know until you just said it that he hired you to ESPN. That's a pretty cool connection.
Yeah, he was, and the people who were from the Dan Patricks of the world, all the way down, obviously Vitale especially, but Howie was the man behind the curtain for so long, and that was really him. The Stump the Schwab was really him, in terms of like, I think a lot of people just assume that was like, oh, nobody knows all this, whatever, and he did, and he was a huge like impact for a lot of people. Like Felica is another one who, they had the Long Island connection and everything, but like, I forgot how many careers he actually helped get off the ground, and probably countless people who would have sounded like idiots on live TV if he wasn't in their ear off stage.
Right. Well, obviously our condolences to his family. I'm glad we got that question. It was good to myself to get back on the mic here and talk college football for 45 minutes. We will be back with another episode next week. As always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.